Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Stan Magidson, and I'm chair and CEO of the Alberta Securities Commission. And I will act as a moderator for today's discussion. I would like to thank everybody for taking the time to attend this open session to further explore issues raised in CSA consultation paper 81408, and also to thank those of you who submitted comment letters. This is an important matter, and we appreciate your input. In terms of agenda for today, we will provide some background information about this initiative. We won't provide a lot of detail, as we expect that everyone has read the consultation paper. Next, we will summarize themes from the comment letters and detail alternatives that have been provided for the CSA's consideration. Then we propose to go to some specific questions to obtain your input. Finally, we'll open the floor for your general comments. Our goal today is to listen, to obtain feedback and suggestions on how we can achieve better investor outcomes. Please be aware that this event is being publicly webcast. Members of the public on the webcast will also have the opportunity to comment, which will be facilitated by members of the ASC team. Now, this will be later on in our program. There will be this opportunity, of course, for you to comment in this forum, and we'll have a microphone that will circulate to you when you ask your question. And please do, at the beginning, state your name and the organization that you represent. That will be very helpful for everybody who's listening in. At this point, I'd like to introduce you to those ASC staff team members who are working on this project. From our corporate finance division on my left is Tom Graham, the director of corporate finance. Ashlyn Daou, senior legal counsel on my immediate right, and Danielle Mayhew on her right, legal counsel with the corporate finance branch. By way of background, the current consultation paper builds on work done previously by CSA members on challenges relating to embedded commissions. In the consultation paper 81408, we identified the following three key investor protection and market efficiency issues stemming from the payment of embedded commissions. Firstly, embedded commissions raise conflicts of interest that misalign the interests of investment fund managers, dealers, and representatives with those of investors. Secondly, embedded commissions reduce investor awareness, understanding, and control of dealer compensation costs. And thirdly, embedded commissions paid generally do not align with the services provided to investors. Through that consultation paper, we sought input on the potential effects on investors and market participants of discontinuing fund embedded commissions, including on the provision and accessibility of advice for Canadian investors and business models and market structure. Secondly, potential measures that could assist in mitigating any negative impacts of such a change if a decision is made to move forward. And thirdly, alternative options that could sufficiently manage or mitigate the identified investor protection and market efficiency issues raised by embedded commissions. We received extensive input in more than 140 letters. Industry provided a number of suggestions for alternatives to banning embedded fees, Today's consultation is focused on consideration of several of the alternatives that were proposed. Another element of our consultation was a survey conducted of retail investors within Alberta. We just received preliminary results of our survey with Albertans regarding embedded fees. We're still going through the details, so this is intended to be a very high-level summary. The final survey includes responses from Albertans who currently hold investment accounts, not including through their employers, as well as those who say they will open such an account in the next 5 years. It was a representative sample with 808 respondents from across Alberta, Calgary, Edmonton, small urban and rural communities. 64% of Albertans are either investors or likely investors. 37% of Albertans are investors who work with an advisor who manages their primary account. Financial literacy is low, generally. 86% of all respondents correctly answered half or less than half of the general financial literacy questions correctly. 6 in 10, 59% of Albertans, are unfamiliar with embedded fees. Among investors with advisors, 4 in 10 do not know how much direct or embedded fees they pay. Only a third know how much they pay, either directly or through embedded fees. Respondents with the highest level of investment knowledge are most likely to pick fee-based accounts. More respondents prefer to pay out of pocket than to have the fees embedded within products. Albertan investors are concerned about conflicts of interest and want transparency. Now, I'm going to ask Danielle and Ashlyn to provide an overview of the themes from the comment letters we received, including proposed alternatives to discontinuing embedded commissions. With that, I'd now like to turn it over to you, Danielle.
Thanks, Dan. So as Dan mentioned, there are several key themes that we identified in the comment letters, so I'll be providing a brief summary of them. So we heard a lot from industry, and as expected, they're strongly opposed to the ban, with some exceptions. They see it as an extreme solution. They also dispute the harms from embedded commissions that we set out in the paper, but they do acknowledge that there is room to enhance our current rules. One of industry's criticisms is that the CSA focus does not consider the overall value of advice. They tended to have a holistic view of their client's financial position and emphasize the additional benefits of financial advice, such as advice about tax planning, retirement planning, and debt reduction, as well as promoting ongoing savings. Another criticism is that the CSA is not considering what market forces have already accomplished. They pointed out that mutual fund fees have decreased overall and that trailing commissions have essentially become standardized. Industry has indicated that banning will exacerbate the already existing advice gap, and they've told us that small dealers will not be able to continue to service mass market investors because it won't be economical, the systems and process changes will be expensive, especially for small dealers, fees will have to be increased, and investors will likely not pay directly for this service, especially if the costs are to rise. They've also suggested that it is likely that minimum account sizes will have to be set. $100,000 was the most common value provided, such that those investors with an account size less than this will not have access to service. We're also told that banning will harm independent dealers' ability to survive, and it will favor the banks because of their size, integration, and ability to rely on other branches of their business. It also suggests that we already have the tools necessary to address conflict concerns. So the first being recently implemented disclosure initiatives, such as the point of sale, which requires fund facts disclosure, the preparation of a fund facts document, and CRM2, which requires disclosure of investment fund performance at the account level, and commissions and other amounts paid to dealers. It's also worth noting that one of the objectives of CRM2 was to increase investor awareness of trailing commissions paid to dealers. And the second tool we already have is our ongoing targeted reforms initiative, which aims to improve relationships with clients. We were told about a number of negative consequences that may result from the ban. The first would be, so less access to financial advice means less use of financial advice, which results in lower savings for retirement. This, combined with low interest environment and lack of pensions for most investors, means a reduction in retirement savings overall that will have a negative social impact. They've suggested there may be a higher cost for advice under a fee-based system. They've also expressed a concern over regulatory arbitrage, such that duly licensed dealers will move their clients into insurance products to avoid a ban of embedded fees on the mutual fund side and take advantage of no ban on the insurance side. And finally, there may be potential tax consequences with direct pay arrangements. So, for example, adding GST or HST, as well as capital gains or losses. So that was a view of industry. We also heard from investor advocates who, again, as we expected, favored banning embedded commissions. It seems though this won't go far enough for them, as they also wanted to do this in conjunction with implementing a best interest standard and the targeted reforms initiative. And the majority of investors also supported a ban. And those that did not support a ban did so on the basis that investors should have a choice as to how they pay their fees and that the CSA shouldn't remove one of those choices. So now I'll turn it over to Ashlyn, who will describe the alternatives that industry suggested to discontinuing embedded fees.
Thanks, Danielle. Pardon me. I'll start with the alternatives that were suggested related to the options that we already have at our disposal as the CSA. The first suggestion was enforcing 81-105, the mutual fund practices rule. There are compensation sections, including trailing fees, in that instrument, although it was also noted that that rule hasn't been updated for quite some time and could use some updating. We also were asked to give the point of sale and CRM2 initiatives time to work, monitor them for a period of time, and then evaluate their success. The problems that we see with the embedded commissions may be resolved once we've reviewed these initiatives and their results. There was also the comment that there's already an indication that these initiatives that we've already implemented or are currently implementing are having a positive effect. There was also the comment that registrants are suffering from regulatory overload. There are just too many things coming at them all at once, and it's hard on a registrant from a time and cost perspective. The third suggestion of issues that we have available at our fingertips is to pursue the targeted reforms that have already been published for comment, and a number of those initiatives that are included in that project may also be of assistance with the embedded fees. Moving on to some of the alternatives that were suggested that would be new to us or that we would have to implement, are the most common comment was capping or standardizing trailing commissions. Capping being setting the upper limit and you can operate within that limit. Standardizing being mandating a set figure for an amount. 0.5%, 0.9%, 1%, and you have to actually operate the fund at that, or pardon me, the trailing commission would have to be that particular percent. Now, I did notice that in the comment letters there seemed to be a bit of a jurisdictional difference with the comments, with commenters out of Quebec seem to prefer the standardization option, whereas other commenters either preferred capping or didn't express an opinion. We will be asking you about that suggestion that industry made and what would be the most effective approach later in the program. Another alternative that was suggested was requiring that the direct pay option be made available to investors, but that investors have the choice of whether to choose an embedded fee model or the direct fee model, whichever is right for the client. It was suggested we could mandate that as an option. Also, we could require dealers to enter into an agreement with their client at account opening and have them agree as to what fee model the client prefers, and then it's in writing. It would be not only the client's choice, but over time the client could go back and revisit, hopefully as they become more and more successful as an investor. The next suggestion was prescribing a minimum list of services that must be provided to investors in order to receive, so that the dealer can receive the embedded fee. Reducing the number of fund series and standardizing naming conventions and characteristics of the fund. That was an interesting suggestion from industry. Eliminating or setting regulations around the deferred sales charge. There were more comments about banning the deferred sales charge than I had expected. There were also some comments about putting parameters around them to help with some of the regulatory issues that we've seen with that option over time. That's another one that we'll want to discuss with the group and get your feedback on. Prohibiting, if possible, order execution only dealers from receiving full trailing commissions. That was another popular comment. Focusing on efforts to improve financial literacy of investors. That came up in the comment letters quite a bit. And also enhancing disclosure of fees, in particular the management expense ratio, and making sure that clients have information about their full cost of product ownership. There were a number of other suggestions about disclosure. We won't go through all of them, but the management expense ratio was the most common. And that's a summary of the alternatives from industry. So I'll turn that back over to Stan for his comments.
Well, thanks, Danielle and Ashlyn. So you got a bit of a high-level sense of the comments and feedback we received to the consultation paper, and Ashlyn then, I think, gave some greater elaboration on some of the alternatives that were suggested primarily by industry. So it's really, I think, the purpose of this forum where we would like to really obtain your additional feedback on three of the alternative options that were suggested. The first option that we'd like your feedback on is the capping or standardizing of trailing commissions. We'd like to consider whether capping, i.e. setting a maximum rate for fees, or standardizing, i.e. setting a specific rate for fees, could sufficiently mitigate the conflict of interest that is created by trailing commissions. We'd also like to discuss the potential impacts of these alternatives on access to advice and competition in the marketplace. The second option we'd like your feedback on is the use of the deferred sales charge purchase option, or the DSC. We'd like to know the potential impacts that the elimination of the DSC might have on access to advice, dealer business models, and competition in the marketplace. And the final option we'd like your feedback on is with respect to enhancements to disclosure. We'd like to know about your experience with our recent disclosure initiatives such as CRM2 and point of sale, and what further disclosure enhancements you think would be valuable to investors. We actually have some specific questions regarding each option. And in that regard, I'd now like to turn the session over to Tom Graham. Over to you, Tom.
Okay, thanks, Dan. And thank you, everyone, for attending today. So we're going to just basically put up those questions that Stan talked about. And when you see one that strikes your fancy and you'd like to add something to, just please put up your hand. We'll bring a microphone and get your comments on it. So as Stan mentioned, one of the first issues that put forward was to putting some kind of limits on trailing commissions. So the first question is, you know, if we were to consider some of these limits, is there a preference or a more effective preference between a cap, so up to X percent, versus some coming up with some sort of standardized trailer fee? And if you have one of those choices, why or why not? That's really what we're getting to is not necessarily the answer, but why that answer.
Mark Kent, Portfolio Strategies Corporation. We'd suggested capping trailing commissions some time ago in previous comments. I think the CSA felt that when you had a 1% trailer for, let's say, equity funds or balance funds, some fund companies were offering 1.25%, and some component of the advisor force might automatically go to the 1.25%. So if that's a perceived conflict of interest, I think capping equity and balance funds at 1% would eliminate that conflict, so you wouldn't have a big range. So I think if you capped it at, you know, 1% or less, you've got the mainstream of the industry that's servicing the average Canadian, and you're also still going to allow some firms who have been very vocal on banning embedded comp to compete on price. So if the industry norm is 1% trail and someone says, well, I'm going to do it for 75 basis points, and if that is a fund family or a fund that the advisors want to use because it's good performance, then that choice is still there. I think it should be set by asset class, so you can't have, obviously, 1% on a money market fund when rates are less than 1%. So, you know, it's been traditional, a quarter point on high interest accounts, half a percent on fixed income funds that were done on a front-end zero basis, 1% on equities. The access to advice, I'm not sure that directly ties into this, because the access to advice is more for, I think, the DSE comment. And, you know, we're a firm. We have 302 advisors, $3.25 billion in assets. We do have a fee-for-service offering. A lot of dealers do not have a fee-for-service offering. Now some fund companies are coming up with it. But I think at the end of the day, most advisors would prefer to avoid being set with one particular mutual fund company. So you may recognize brand X is great for Canadian equity, brand B is good for global equity. So to have everything under one roof just for some consolidated fee collection is not ideal, but I know some fund companies are working on that solution.
That's great. Thanks, Mark. And I'll pass it over to Estelle here. Just quickly, I'll read the rest of the questions that are on this slide, because they do kind of all go together, and Mr. Kent tied his responses to all three of them, or spoke to all three of them. So the first one is, you know, specifically differentiating between capping versus some kind of standardized trailing commission, and then if a cap were applied, should it be applied across all asset classes or differentiated between asset classes? And then finally, you know, if the option was chosen to cap or standardize, what impact, intended or otherwise, unintended consequences might that have? Competition in the market? Would it limit access to advice for investors? Would there be increased movement to direct pay models? So those are some of the related questions. So I'll put them all out there, because they are all related. Sorry.
Hi, my name is Rob Sklar. I'm from Fidelity Investments. And just to carry on from the previous gentleman who spoke before, it's actually interesting, because you raise cap or standardized commissions. When you start reading the comment letters that were provided, some of them are talking about standardizing when they mean cap or vice versa. I would argue that right now, either a cap or standardized trailing commission, the biggest point is that it maintains the current embedded fee model. The embedded fee model for investors is very important, so it kind of keeps that in play. In terms of a cap or standardized trailing commission, I would argue that, from an industry perspective, I would say the industry is kind of almost already there in terms of standardized rates. Certainly, our preference would be to have a cap, because a cap would allow fund managers to set a range that's or set a fee that is below the cap. Certainly, we're in an era, as Ms. Mayhew pointed out, where we're seeing a number of fund companies reduce fees. And I think that having a cap is probably more appropriate, so long as the cap is sort of set at a relevant range by asset class and set at industry standards. Again, in terms of your question 3A, in terms of access to advice for investors, it's very important, I think, as regulators, when talking about, investor protection and fostering fair and efficient capital markets, that we maintain as much choice as we can for investors. To limit choice is arguably never good for investors, but to preserve choice is good, and so long as, there's different explanations of the different fee models, and investors, Canadian investors deserve a chance to save for their retirement and choose as to how they wish their dealer advisor to be paid. But certainly in terms of capping or standardizing trailing commissions, it lets the embedded fee model continue.
So to flip that question around a little bit, do you think either of these options limit?
Not per se, but again, I would say that in terms of the mutual fund industry, there is research to suggest that, certainly we're already there in terms of standardization. So we have, a number of fund companies that apply sort of the same or similar trailing commission rate on different types of asset classes. But again, a cap would be more effective because, as opposed to standardization, because it allows the fund manager to determine a price that may be lower than the cap than having sort of an arbitrary price control set at one rate.
Right. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Pete Cote. I'm not representing anyone but myself, but I see a really big risk on this page. The premise that we tend to be operating under is that commissions, by their very nature, create a bias. I disagree with that idea, but I understand where it comes from. If you have a different cap on different sectors of funds, you have not removed the bias, you've just deflected it. And I think that's the unintended consequence that you could have. I am not opposed in any way, shape, or form on a cap. But if you have different caps for different asset classes, I think you just created the same problem again in the minds of the advocates. So I think we have to guard against that.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jim Dernan. I'm an independent financial advisor, a relatively large advisor. I only do mutual funds. I run about $188 million of client assets under management. I've been doing this for 24 years professionally. I'm licensed through Asante Financial Management. In regards to, I'll agree with the gentleman's point from Fidelity that for the most part, the market has standardized compensation for almost all asset classes. In effect, putting a cap, I think, would work very well. Generally, from an advisor perspective, the compensation, for the most part, has been tied historically to how much service we have to provide for having a client, for example, in a medium to high or high investment portfolio versus a medium or medium low risk investment portfolio. And that's, I believe, how they were initially set. I think effectively balanced funds are a little bit less risky and a little bit lower maintenance from an advisor perspective, so that could perhaps be taken into consideration. And I guess that's point 2A, specific rate across all asset classes. You know, I think it's worthwhile talking about the average Canadian and the unintended consequences of removing embedded compensation. Now, I don't know if you have a separate slide on that or not, because the gentleman did comment on embedded comp. Is this appropriate to talk about here for a second?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so in my business, we service all types of clients. We have no minimum. My smallest client has, say, $3,000 with me. My largest client has $18.5 million with me. And all of these clients, particularly the larger clients, have worked with us in excess of 15 years. And they are finding the amount of information that they are now receiving since the point of sale initiative and the investor cost disclosure initiative to be overwhelming. As well, on fund company statements now, you have dollar costs disclosed as well, too. So for those that are interested, because most of them are interested in net performance after investor cost, which is the overriding driver to a successful outcome for an investor, but those that are interested, they do ask questions, and we do explain in detail how much they have paid over multiple years, so they have that information if they are interested in that. But most investors are interested in outcome rather than what am I paying for a specific thing. My last comment on this point will be what I'll call the disintermediation of the average Canadian. So at a cost to me, from a profitability perspective, we have chosen to make our services available for those clients that have less than $100,000, those that have less than $50,000. You know, we want some type of win-win, so we want them to be focused on financial success over time. But the only way that we can get at all compensated in a reasonable fashion for providing the 20-plus hours of work that we do up front before a client becomes a client is through some type of upfront payment. Otherwise, essentially, we're offering our services for free because we don't know how long the client will stay with us. And therefore, the deferred service compensation model for smaller clients works extremely well. It becomes some type of win-win, and it allows them the opportunity to access the independent advice channel, which, in my mind, has more knowledge than what they would receive in going to a bank branch or something like that.
Okay, and we are going to get specifically to deferred sales charges here in a minute. And just I should just clarify, we are going to have we're going to go through some specific questions, but we're also going to have some time at the end for some general comments. So just mention that fellow there, please. Thanks.
David Clark with BMO Asset Management. A couple of things that come to mind. I wonder if the panel has considered the recent, by way of the last sort of 4 or 5 years, strong conversion of the industry to a fee-based environment, the unintended consequences that has had for investors in raising the overall price in the market. A conversion from an embedded commission model to a fee-based, fully disclosed model has actually raised the cost of advice for investors. To Mr. Dernan's point about outcome-based results, one of the questions earlier was about increasing focus on investor education. Education, I don't think, is necessarily the right way, because education doesn't necessarily foster engagement. And just because somebody's aware of various facts or it doesn't necessarily make them care. What we're really aiming for in this industry is people to be engaged in their financial affairs. And I don't believe that focusing on investor education is going to achieve that outcome. A couple of other things that I wish the panel would comment on and consider is the idea of standardizing by asset class. Standardizing by asset class creates a further conflict, because it puts in advisors and clients in a situation where what may be best for the client's personal circumstances may alter the revenue model for the advisor. and may skew the advisor to recommending a more aggressive asset mix that may be suitable for the client's situation. Lastly, one of the things that I have not seen discussed or in your presentation is the idea of forcing all advisors to offer the clients a choice of fee-based or embedded. We're in a situation now where some advisors only offer embedded, where others offer only fee-based, and allowing the client to go to the same advisor and make a choice of which model they would like to use with the same advisor is something we have not heard much comment about, where clients now or prospective clients are forced to go to multiple different providers in order to get a proposal because certain advisors operate only on one model.
Okay, those are good comments. And just, you know, to clarify, just because we haven't mentioned something, it's not that we're avoiding them and we don't have an agenda here. So when you say that we're the panel, we're really seeking feedback. We happen to be sitting at this table, but there's nothing more to it than that. So those are good points. Thank you.
I just want to make one comment. This gentleman, I think it's Peter in front of me, I think they're saying that if there's an opportunity to put clients in funds that pay 1%, we'll do that instead of a 0.5% trail fund. But I would point out this should be captured in a KYC suitability analysis. So if a client is a low-risk client, the compliance department should have a hard stop on people going completely into equities at 1%. So that needs to be, I think, acknowledged.
Thank you. And I should just mention there are our colleagues that are working on the targeted reforms here today, because we do know that these two projects are, you know, you can't separate them. And those are important considerations. So,
thank you. It's Rob Sklar again from Fidelity Investments. One thing I'd like to add on to the gentleman from BMO, and if I heard you correctly, that you mentioned that, you know, in some cases the movement to a fee-based account might result in higher costs. If I didn't hear you correctly, then I apologize. But that was one thing that was noted in the recent IROC report coming out of their compensation-related conflicts review earlier this year. And, you know, the one thing that I wanted to touch on is that, you know, a fee-based environment is not conflict-free. There are numerous conflicts of interest that exist in a fee-based environment. And it's funny that we're not here today debating the merits of a fee-based model, but rather the embedded fee model. So, you know, in some cases, there, you know, a fee-based model works well for investors, but in other cases, they will result in higher costs for some investors, and especially the ones that were noted in the consultation paper. Those mass market households that fall under $100,000 may not necessarily be suitable for a fee-based account, and that was something that IROC did note in their report. Thank you.
Yeah, and just, you know, for the record, we have heard that feedback and the studies and the information, so that's all being put into the feedback that we're applying to wherever we land.
Robert McCullough, I'm here today as an advisor with an independent practice, but I'm heavily involved as a volunteer for advocates as well, so I wanted just to make sure there's no conflict of interest in my comments. With regard to the cap, I think it's preferential to standardizing. Gives the opportunity for a little bit of still market competition and allows us to provide value at different levels and at different price points up to an agreed-to standard. As far as the specific rate, I think it's following the industry is really the right way. As Mark Kent has pointed out, it's already somewhat established and seems to make sense to follow that. And if I understand Pete Cote's comment, was the perception of the critics would be that there'd be a bias that remained, not actually an advisor having a bias, that I don't believe an advisor would make that choice after speaking to many, many advisors. As far as access to advice, We need to increase access to advice, and I don't believe that this is actually going to have an impact to increasing or decreasing it. Quite frankly, I thought it was already standardized. It was only when I sat with the OSC and they told me that some people paid more than 1% on an equity fund that I found out that existed. So it'd be interesting to poll advisors to see if they actually knew that there was a higher trading fees at some companies than others. I bet you'd find out most advisors don't even know that. Because we don't, that's not what we drive for. We drive for the service. We drive for relationship. We drive for the value creation that we understand in exchange for a fair compensation for our time and efforts. And I underscore what Jim said. We put a lot of upfront time into taking care of this. And in many of these revisions to our compensation, it seems to give very little consideration to how much energy we put into building, creating, delivering good financial services and advice, and almost that we have to underwrite and carry the cost of that for many years to get back to a point where we've broken even. And we already are facing enough pressure, not only here, but in many other different ranges where increasingly being a self-employed small business owner starting to become less and less desirable. And so that is probably, in my mind, the bigger issue that I would be concerned about in some of these changes. But in regard to the answers, those are my thoughts.
Okay. Thank you. And just maybe if I could drill down a little bit on the, sort of the advice, impact on advice. Is it the trailing commissions, are they the preferred model, I guess, because of the problems associated with other kinds of fee models, or like, is it the ease of calculation, or people understand that question, or am I?
I don't understand your question.
Just is it sounds like that there's still a preference for trailing commissions, and that changing them dramatically would affect potentially smaller clients and impact perhaps an advice gap. Is there something specific with that, the way that that's calculated and paid, that's preferable over other models? And specifically what that is.
Giovanni Luria from Hollis Wealth. I think a comment to your question there is, if you've got certain clients that, case in point, if we got rid of embedded commissions and we had to move some of our smaller clients to a fee-based account, I'm just talking directly by my firm, we have to then set up new accounts, basically another form of another type of account, which that client now has to pay specifically for that specific account, which becomes a fee-based account. So on our side, there is a fee that the client pays for that. So on top of the fee that I'm going to then ultimately have to charge my client, my firm's going to have to charge a client fee to hold that account. So logistically, it will change a lot of things. So for my smaller clients that we spend numerous hours to go back to them and say, you're now, last 5 years we haven't been charging you, on a specific model to hold this, for example, a PFSA. Now we got to hold it in this nominee form. You're going to get charged $100 a year just to hold this account. They're going to look at me and say, well, what's this for? Well, this is something that's been implemented, and this is going to be on top of the fee that you're going to pay, the embedded fee that we used to charge for our services and time. So it becomes logistically, it does change.
Okay, we got one more comment. I know I didn't ask that question very clearly, but you answered the question that I was trying to ask, so thank you.
I just want to piggyback on what he was saying. Sorry, Pete Cote. It's about the value proposition that advisors bring to the table. And I think we could probably all agree that if we, I'm just going to use a really bad analogy, if we all moved a couple hundred miles south and we had to go pay our doctor for a physical every time we showed up or a flu shot or everything like that, I would hazard a guess that most of us wouldn't do it. When you have, this is a horrible phrase to use, I apologize, if you have a silent fee, that's disclosed. It's there. We tell them it's there. CRM2 tells them it's there. Their statements tell them it's there. But it pays for all of the stuff that they're not aware that it's paying for. So clients as a whole are lazy, and they would rather take the passive approach than the active approach. And if I said to probably half my clients, sorry, you now have to pay me $100 a year to maintain this account, or you have to pay $100 for this or $50 for that, or use an a la carte system as they use in Britain, you would find that not only would the advice gap get wider, it wouldn't be a gap anymore, it'd be a canyon. I think you'd see so many people back away from even trying to save that they'd never get started. And that's the risk I think we need to discuss. I think this stuff's all great, but to me it's noise. We have to go back to the basic issue of, does this create the advice gap that we're all so fearful of?
Thank you. It's Rob Sklar again. So I'm also an investor in an embedded fee model. And, you know, when I started out years and years ago, I wasn't as concerned with how my dealer advisor got paid. As I got older, you know, I started to get more aware of the fees. But I have to tell you, I've got a young family at home. I've got so many expenses, my monthly expenses actually that I have to pay directly for, mortgage, all the utilities, food and groceries, not to mention all my children's programs that they're, you know, that they're involved in. And the fact that I'm an embedded fee model, I'm happy with right now, because the last thing I need is another bill coming in the door for something that I have to pay for. You know, as I get older and perhaps more, you know, more knowledgeable, and I want to rejig how I do my my investments, I may change my mind. But right now, I am quite happy with being in the embedded fee model, that I don't have to see, you know, a bill for investment advice. And honestly, it's the peace of mind that I get knowing that I've used the same advisor for a number of years. I trust him. He's making good investment choices for me, for my family. And, you know, it's something that I don't have to worry about. But if I get a bill, you know, whether I pay it monthly or yearly or hourly, it's something that I'm not going to be used to seeing. And I really don't need another bill right now. So, you know, from just me speaking on behalf of, you know, me being an investor, I'm quite happy in the embedded fee model, and I don't want that choice taken away from me. I think that having the choice and, you know, deciding later on if I want to move to a fee-based account, I should be entitled to make that choice. But right now, I'm choosing the embedded fee model. I'm content with how my dealer and how my financial advisor is being compensated, and he's doing a good job for me. If he's not doing a good job for me, then I'll go out and find another advisor. That's, you know, it's easy as that. But right now, I'm content, and my advisor is doing a great job for me. Thank you.
Rob, you've stressed me out. I realized I forgot to pay a bill this morning.
Mark Kent, Portfolio Strategies. One of the options that the CSA put forward was charging an hourly rate, invoicing for services. And this is a somewhat facetious question, but how much do you think a client would be willing to pay for a KYC update? Most clients don't perceive a value in a KYC update. It's basically a butt-covering exercise for the dealer and the advisor, and for a lot of the clients, it's nothing more than that. So I'm not looking forward to the day when I say, okay, your 1, 2, or 3 years are up, depending on which national instrument we're running with, and you have to come in for a KYC update. Well, it's not going to cost you more. Well, it'll probably be an hour or two, and here's the hourly rate. I'm kind of busy. I'm golfing that day. So that's something that I think the regulators really need to understand, that that is a massive conflicting issue to invoice for services that the clients do not perceive as value. We've talked about the value of advice. Everyone agrees that clients that are advised generally have better outcomes than non-advised clients. And I think that's a critical component. But the service piece and charging an hourly rate for KYC update, I think, is going to be problematic. As to issuing invoices with my dealer hat on now, I don't really want to be in the collection business. My advisors do not want to deliver services which could be many, many hours of planning and risk not getting paid. That is somewhat solved in the embedded commission model. And I think that's absolutely critical. Some have attacked, and maybe I'm just getting a bit ahead on the DSC, but, you know, deferred sales charge is maybe 20-30% of our dealer revenue today. And a lot of that revenue that is there is for flow-through shares. It's not even necessarily mutual fund specific, so that's been falling over the years. And a bigger piece of our revenue is in a trailer fee model, which I think is what the CSA was looking for several years ago. So I think the outcome is moving in the right direction, but I do caution you to not push too hard in this payment for services, because I just don't think clients are going to say, I'm going to come in and do that KYC update, even if it costs me $500.
Thank you. We're first.
Okay, we'll take a couple more on this, and I'm mindful of time and want to get through the rest, but these are all good. Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Jim Dernan. A couple of points to make. The banks and the brokerage channels in the banks have moved towards eliminating smaller clients from access to perhaps their best advice channel, that being traditionally the stockbrokers, whatever they're calling themselves today. They have done that for a reason, because they have moved from transactional costs of buying and selling securities, which was the model 20 years ago, to some type of trailer model, whether it's through F-class shares or embedded trailing commissions like we're speaking about now, for consistency of revenue. And I can tell you, because I compete against the big five all the time, that almost 100% of the time, the broker that I'm competing against is being paid between 25% to 50% more to service that client than what we would charge them in a standardized trailing commission embedded fee model, 100% of the time. In regards to successful outcomes, I think that's what we have to think about, you know, taking the average Canadian and fighting for the average Canadian so that they can have some level of financial comfort and financial independence over time. Looking at investor behavior, I believe it is best served, as the gentleman from Fidelity mentioned, through an embedded fee model. All of the movements that we have seen, not all, because point of sale was out 15 years ago, but the talk of point of sale, but all of the major regulatory movements that we have seen in regards to disclosure to clients, et cetera, has come in a period, for the most part, of rising investment markets. Some of us have been in the business for a long time and seen the damage that can be done in a bear market, particularly an extended bear market like 2000 to 2003, when the markets declined for 3 years in a row. When clients are consistently looking at investor cost, whether it's being billed monthly or disclosed monthly or however it is disclosed, their ability to trust their advisor, even though the advisor might be the smartest person in the advisor community, starts to mitigate over time, because they're constantly losing money. And yet they're dishing out relatively large amounts of investor cost to be properly invested. And the studies, certainly through Delbar, point out that investor behavior, which for an advisor is huge to have a successful long-term outcome, can be, in my mind, significantly mitigated under a non-embedded fee structure, meaning that the client will make a poor decision because he's seeing that $3,000 a month bill come in on his $3 million account, and yet he's losing money year after year in an extended bear market. So I would be very careful to let a full market cycle manifest itself under the current disclosures and see how that plays out.
Okay, thank you. One more. Oh, sorry, was there one back there? Rob, somebody's beat you there.
My name is Tony Poston. I'm with Investia Financial Services. I've been in this business for more years than I care to remember, and we have a system that I feel has worked extremely well, will continue to do well, and when I see the tinkering that is going on by those that aren't in the trenches and do not totally understand what the system, what do we work with our clients, what they go through, every situation is different. I'm extremely concerned about the unintended consequences. And we find that in many issues, not only in the financial services industry, where this type of thing happens, the unintended consequences are fairly major. So I'm not for the tinkering. I think we have the options there for me to well service my clients. My clients have been with me for many years. I have hardly any migration away, and I believe that that can continue. So my advice is hands off. Thank you very much.
Okay. One more here, Robin, then we'll switch to the next question. And if we need to come back, Dan, on some of these, we can.
Sure. So please forgive me, but just a fact from Ontario. I believe either late August or in September, the Ontario government released the average individual income is about $34,000. The 2017 tax rate is about 20% of that, which leaves about $27,000 left for the individual, the average individual, to spend. And 35 to 50% of that amount is spent on housing and utilities, which leaves not much more for living expenses like food, clothing, and transportation. So after all that is said and done, it doesn't leave very much disposable income left to invest. So, you know, it's those investors, too, that we look at and say, do we really want to force them to pay direct? Because if they're given, if they're forced to go into a fee-based model where they have to pay direct fees, they might forego investment advice altogether. So I just wanted to, I don't know what the statistics are for Albertans, the average Albertan income, individual income, but if it's, you know, approximately or similar to the average Ontarian, then it doesn't leave very much to invest.
Thank you. So I do want to switch gears here and talk specifically about deferred sales charges or DSCs, and we've touched on this a bit, so we might not spend quite as long on this, but specifically on deferred sales charges, what people view as some of the benefits. Again, with the discontinuation of DSCs, reduce access to advice, you know, particularly those under 100,000, which I think would definitely be under those numbers that Mark talked about, and some of the reasons there. And would there be a disproportionate effect on certain business models? And then finally, you know, if it were to continue in some form, would there be additional parameters that could be placed around the use of DSCs?
David Clark, BMO Global Asset Management. As much as this might sound somewhat counterintuitive, given the organization for whom I work, I think a healthy independent advisor market is essential for Canadians. And banning DSCs, the deferred sales charge model is used almost exclusively by the independent advisor. It's almost unheard of for in-bank advisors to use deferred sales charge. And so banning deferred sales charge would drive more small clients into the bank branch channels, which would limit the ability of the independent advisor and limit the opportunity set for the independent advisor. And I think that it's essential that we have a strong independent advisor community to provide access to Canadians.
Tony Poston again. As far as DSCs are concerned, I do believe that they have their place in some situations where I've found in my practice over the years that they can be just a bit of a deterrent if an individual is more of a spendthrift type of an individual, thus not wanting to pay the DSC charges in the early years. They tend to leave their investments intact, which is a plus for them. Thank you.
So the investor's making that conscious choice.
Well, the investor, I give them the choice going in. What options are
what going in, what options are available, and what options they want to choose. However, I also will point them in the direction of a deferred sales charge if I deem it to be an advantage for them. Like I said, if you're going to cash in your fund to buy a case of beer, I don't think that's in your best interest.
I've only done that once.
Wow.
Yeah.
Look out, Tony.
Pete Cote again. On DSC, I wanted to make 4 points. Only a client can trigger a DSC. If you're sitting with a client and making a long-term retirement plan, and I am specifically speaking of retirement products, and they want to work with you over a period of time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, if they choose to leave you 3 years later, that was their decision. If you're a horrible advisor and they want to switch advisors, they can transfer the money within the fund company and not trigger a DSC charge. The only time a DSC charge is triggered is when usually someone on the other side talks them into it. I would put that up against a front-end load charge any day of the week. If a client gives me $100,000 DSC, they invest $100,000. If they give me $100,000 and we agree to a 2% front-end load, they only invest $98,000. I don't know where you come from, but I call that theft. And I'm totally opposed to any kind of front-end load charge when it comes to this type of investment. Pensions are very successful because they're not accessible to the client, except under very dire circumstances. A DSC can take an ordinary RRSP and turn it into a pension-type account because all of a sudden to access it creates a charge that mitigates poor client behavior. And sometimes clients need that added incentive to leave their money the hell alone. I'm not in favor of DSCs on something like a TFSA or an RESP, which are relatively short-term money. And a TFSA could be needed next week. So to DSC that, I think, is just poor behavior on the part of the advisor. But I've had clients specifically sit in front of me and say, we talk about DSC versus front-end load versus no load. Please DSC this. I need all the incentive I can get to leave my money alone. I don't think there should be any kind of cap on it. People keep throwing around $100,000 and less could be DSC'd because of the relative cost of practice management to the advisor. I think there's a lot more to it than that. But speaking of that, deferred sales charge does allow a relatively new advisor to develop their practice the way it needs to be developed. And if they're constantly under financial duress and not able to generate enough income to go out and learn the things they need to learn, invest in the things they need to invest in to make themselves successful, they're not going to be around 5 years from now, and the client has really wasted their time. So there's a lot of good things on the DSC side, not in every circumstance, but there's a lot more good than I think there is bad. And I think all of this stuff comes back to the same thing. Everything we talk about, whether it's a cap, whether it's DSC, whether it's commissions in general, I think we're trying to protect the customer from the bad performer. I think anyone who's ethical, anyone who puts their clients first, none of this really means anything because it's never going to be an issue.
Robert McCullough. One of the benefits, and I would agree with what Tony said, only using it in a slightly different fashion, I've had parents who want to use DSC on their money so that they can tell their children that they can't access their money as a stopguard to get it so that they can't get there. When I explain to clients the difference between DSC and a front-end zero, the difference in the trailing commission, and at the end of 10 years, they're whole either way. They really come around to the point where they say, well, do whichever works better for you to stay in business. DSCs on registered plans, which have a very long time horizon and plenty of time to expire before the client reaches retirement, allows capital to do the work necessary around building the retirement plan and investing the time to do the financial plan and all of the other pieces, as well as advise on the other areas of their financial plan that they may need direction on, a will, estate planning, divvying of assets, helping them determine what they should do when they're buying their trailer, how should they be accessing credit. I don't get paid for that advice. That advice comes out of a DSC fee. And DSCs allow me the ability to give holistic, comprehensive financial advice in a number of areas that I'm trained to do. I would have to wait a very, very long time with a standardized or capped trailer fee to break even on that advice, and I'll have to reduce it significantly. In addition, I know I've shown my client list to you people before, and one of the things on that client list is that my top clients have 7% of my assets, 7% of my client have 94% of the asset. That means 93% of the other clients have a very small amount of assets with me, but get good advice, the same advice. We don't differentiate it, and the DSC allows us to. Mark gave a great example before about an RESP and how much it costs in a DSC fee when the person's putting $50 a month into their RESP. How much the advisor is going to actually be paid at the end of the year for giving the advice around the RESP and the requirements. So the DSC allows us to offer some very low dollar deposit accounts the advice that they need. Would it reduce access for the mass market? Absolutely. I have 350 client families that are attached to me. I would immediately jettison 200 of them if some of these changes come forward. It's not worth my time or energy. I'm going to focus on my larger accounts or liability. Exactly, Pete. Would certain business models be disproportionately affected by the ban? Of course. We're going to move away from some of the holistic and comprehensive advice and move to more specific, streamlined. I have competition I have to go against, and that competition may not give that advice and therefore reduces their cost. And the client doesn't necessarily know what advice they need when we begin the relationship. We have a much better understanding of what a client's financial literacy and need for advice is going to be over the next 10 years than the client does, because the client doesn't necessarily, they haven't done this before. We also spend a lot of time working with clients who are approaching retirement and how to stream their income. That valuable advice isn't available in a lot of other channels. And I know that all the advisors in this room are doing that. What other parameters? You could probably look to some limits. You could probably look to, you've already put a parameter on that we can't do that work for seniors. Yet the amount of work that's required to take care of a senior that you might take on who's older may require an awful lot of leg time, a lot of investment of my time to take care of somebody who's older, who needs financial advice, who needs assistance with their children, with their estate, with their different issues. And you've restricted that. I now have to hope to God that the person lives long enough that I break even for the effort I put in, or let other people finance that who are in different age categories. So if you want to talk about investor fairness, that's something I think we should talk about.
Hi, it's Jim Dernan. A few comments. I agree with Mr. Clark's comments earlier about having a healthy independent advisor market. You know, one of the things about being an independent that people typically don't get by going to the bank is choice of vendors. So we might use multiple vendors based on the quality of products that are offered. It might even be three different banks to satisfy a client, where if they go into the branch, they go to Bank of Nova Scotia, you know, they get Bank of Nova Scotia products. And, you know, RBC might be the better provider in the marketplace, but they don't have that option. So having a healthy independent advisor market just in regards to product choice is significant. Mr. McCullough's comments about how much different types of work that we do are unbelievable. I have an exemption and we do tax in our practice. You know, so giving tax advice to people is significant, and, you know, we don't charge very much at all for that type of service. And in effect, it's funded through deferred service charge and trailing commissions. In regards to a win-win situation, I've always worked under the philosophy of win-win. So we take on a smaller client, and if we don't have deferred service charge or embedded compensation, the win comes many, many years down the road, a decade down the road, if they are still with you, because there is no guarantee that a client will stay with you for a long period of time. Probably average in the marketplace might be a good survey to do, but I would bet it's less than 5 years that they stay with their advisor. One of the things not discussed is that deferred service charge and low load, which has not been mentioned at all today, certainly in deferred service charge, there's a 10% free option. So the advisor is compensated up front for the work that they do. 10% of that money is available each calendar year to fund even a retirement program. Because if they're cashing out more than 10%, then the money's just not going to last. So, you know, having that automated, mandating the fund companies to do it, you know, would be something that the regulators could consider and would be an automatic win to clients, because I have a very large staff and part of it is doing 10% freeze all the time because it's a manual process. You know, would the discontinuation of DSC reduce access to advice for mass market investors? Absolutely, for the reasons mentioned. Yes, business models will be significantly affected. You know, I'm getting a little bit older over time here, and in order for the industry to be healthy over time with the independent channel, we need to have new entrants. A new entrant basically gives up his paycheck and is a business entrepreneur. He has no real salary, and the only way that they can survive and hopefully become a good advisor over time is through a deferred service charge mechanism, because they have no other source of revenue. So having a healthy independent advisor community over time is dependent on some type of deferred service charge or low load model. You know, one of the other things not discussed is that dealers and advisors have the option to DSC fee rebate clients. So if I take over a client from Investors Group, for example, and there's deferred service charges through my dealer with client authorization, the fees that they pay on leaving Investors Group can be credited back to them. So the advisor, or I'm sorry, the client is not owed any money, doesn't have to be out money in order to work with an advisor over time. Lastly, I'm going to mention a bit more about Dalbar, because Tony mentioned about deterrence for people cashing out their investments. The Dalbar study should be looked into significantly. They do a tremendous amount of research on the impact of investor behavior on client outcomes. The net cost on an equity investor because of poor investment behavior is between 4% and 7% per year over a long-term time period, 20 years. And therefore, if there's any kind of deterrent to significantly impacting investor behavior, whether it's because they're going to get a charge or hopefully advisor expertise or whatever it is, it's a huge benefit to the client, because many people shoot themselves in the foot all the time. And it's not my data. It's from Dalbar in the United States. Thank you.
Okay. I'll get to you, Rob. I do want to switch to the next question here in a minute, and I think we've got a flavor of the responses. Is there anyone that has a significantly contrary view? And I appreciate you might have some nuances and subtleties that you still want to add, but just okay. Rob.
Hi, it's Rob Sklar. I absolutely agree with the vast majority of comments that have been made on this topic. I think, just to sum up, I mean, the key benefits of DSC, they play two very important key benefits. The first is it allows the small investor to get their full amount of their money working for them. The second thing, it allows smaller advisors to service these mass market households. So I absolutely agree that banning DSC would reduce access to mass market investors. And, you know, for example, DSC is used by for RDSPs, for registered disability savings plans, for RESPs as well. And, you know, I also think about that, you know, foreigners coming into Canada, starting a new life in Canada, they have very little amount to invest, and DSC absolutely, if used appropriately, serves mass market investors well. So, I think it was raised previously, but, you know, certainly a ban on DSC would most likely impact the smaller independent dealers. and which would have a ripple effect. So you're going to have investors that won't get access to investment advice at all. You'll have fewer advisors even to service investors in a fee-based world. And so I think, as you probably know, the MFDA, in response to the fourth question, has certainly made the use of DSC a priority over this past year, and certainly the guidance and statements that they've come out with have shown a meaningful improvement on selling DSC securities. So I think with established parameters, as was mentioned before, in terms of some of the alternatives, DSC remains an absolute suitable investment for mass market investors. Thank you.
Okay. We are going to switch gears here a little bit again. If I could get the next slide and talk a little bit about disclosure. So firstly, I guess, would be interested in people's views on a couple of the more recent disclosure initiatives, the Fund Facts document and CRM2, and just are those having an effect? Are they relevant to this debate? I think the answer is probably yes, but what would people's feedback be on some kind of consideration of account opening agreements and whether they should apply in different situations, account-based or commission-based versus all types of compensation? Examples of services that a prescribed list of services might include if something like that were to be considered? And would you support enhanced disclosure of management, MER management expenses? Why or why not? So, that's a good question. Further breakdown of what's included in MER, both percentages and absolute dollar amounts, I guess just more detail, although if you had ideas, I'd be open to those as well. Rob, you want to?
Nope. Giovanni from Hollis Wealth Invest here. I think going back to what a lot of the responses have been and what I've heard, I think we have to give this time through disclosure. I mean, the current CRM2 has recently come into effect. I think we're going into our second year now on full disclosure of fees and trailing commissions and sort of say. But just with my own client base, I mean, have they had an impact? I would say yes and no. I mean, you've got some that will read them. We disclose all our fees up front to all our clients, but in saying that, will a client remember this? No. I mean, but the problem with full disclosure is...
Disclose more than...
Well, we disclose up front what our fees and how we get paid and what the services that we provide to our clients. The thing is, with the amount of paperwork, I was a meeting with a client about 6 months ago. She actually walked downstairs and said, here's a box full of documents that I've received in the last year. I mean, so disclosing this is one thing, but I mean, I'm not sure how this goes about to clients that when they get all this disclosure, I don't know what, I think maybe on an account opening basis might be a way of having something disclosed, because with all these statements that they're receiving, they're bombarded with so much information that I think at the end of the day, they might not even know what it is anymore. I think on an account opening basis, when you initially open an account, there needs to be something there with compensation at that point rather than after the fact. And also, we need to give this more time, but I think it needs to be streamlined where the average investor understands, because right now they are not understanding. There's just been too much disclosure.
In particular on that question on CRM2 and point of sale, when we say are they having an effect, part of that would be, are they encouraging more discussions would be another, way that's showing itself.
Hi, it's Rob Sklar. So first off, what I'd like to say is the regulators should be commended and applauded for their efforts on what they've done with the disclosure. I know. Of fees and performance of investments. I think at first, you know, and looking back years when we were talking about, you know, the implementation of point of sale and CRM3, that it was, you know, again, the proliferation of documents, you know, nobody was going to read them. But I actually think that, you know, even as early as last week with the BCSC coming out with their third and final phase of their research results shows that investors are having a better understanding of fees and the performance of their investments. Do I think that, you know, to your question, I absolutely think that, you know, when I received my CRM2 report, I absolutely discussed it with my advisor. And I think, you know, advisors are having these discussions, more robust discussions around fees and the performance because of these statements. But I think it's also a formality. I think that advisors have been doing this for years and years now. So some of which, who I've spoken with, have said, this is just a formality of something I've already been doing for years. So I think, though, that with the disclosure, it does need time to work its way through. But I do think that investors are becoming more informed, and as a result of which, they're becoming more empowered, and they're making better investment decisions because of it. So I hope that answers your question. Certainly, when I get my reports, you know, I have lots of questions, but at the same time, I understand them better. I understand how they work. And so I think that I'm becoming more of an empowered investor. So that's what I would say about that. On the last question, would you support enhanced disclosure of MER? So why or why not? So I think that, you know, when you look at the number of documents we have available, you know, the fund facts, the prospectus, the CRM2 reports are, you know, a lot of which are disclosing in dollar terms what investors are paying. On mutual funds, it's disclosed in the fund facts what they're paying on every $1,000 invested. But certainly we wouldn't be opposed to enhancing any type of statement to include the management fees on mutual funds. We as Fidelity. Thank you.
Tony Poston, this business is built totally on trust. My clients, out of 300 clients, last year I had conversation about fees with two. That's not a very high percentage. So they don't really look at what these statements say. They trust me to put them into what is best for them. And in my particular case, at the very outset, when we discussed, and I'll just touch a little bit on MERs here, why I might suggest a fund with a little bit higher MER, so it doesn't become an issue that we're price shopping. I use the analogy a lot of times with clients. I say, if you're a farmer and we're growing oats, you'd have to pay a good price for good quality oats. You can get it cheaper, but you'd have to run it through the horse. Thank you.
I was struck yesterday while watching American television at how the fund companies in the United States are making a terrific effort at educating people of the necessity to invest for their retirement. We're seeing things where they're showing people how long they think they'll be retired and how much money they think they need. It strikes me that if you want to make a difference, stop having us drop all this information on the client at the exact moment that we see them. They're overwhelmed. I completely agree with Giovanni's comments. They're absolutely overwhelmed with all the information and all the disclosure, and everything is just too much. Spend your time, focus your energies on educating our clients by questions. Get them to ask us questions. In 25 years, I don't have enough questions from clients asking me about my professionalism, asking me about my education. Why am I a good person to be investing on their behalf? I could come up with 100 questions that you could promote to clients to ask on how to find good financial advice. and what to expect. And when you're looking for a list of prescribed services, we could certainly put that together, but don't hand it to the client. Let's give access to a place where clients can become better educated. Using Rob's comments, that at the end of the day, he's becoming wiser, but he's in the industry. He should be becoming wiser. Outside of that, we need to help our clients. We have a financial literacy task force in Canada that's the most silent task force I've ever seen ever. And I think that we all agree in this room that financial literacy is more very, very important. And I think we need to give clients more questions rather than more documents. So.
Mark Kent, Portfolio Strategies. Just to jump into point one there, the recent experience, I think what's happened is it's causing advisors to review perhaps the amount of time that they're spending with a client. And I'm not sure we did a good enough job on the deferred sales charge discussion, because at the end of the day, it's really what allows advisors to sometimes spend 10, 20, 30 hours of planning work. And I'm not sure that we really nailed that in the last discussion. So, you know, the recent disclosure, I'd say that if you're dealing with a client that's very high maintenance, calls you every time there's a story out of North Korea, that is perhaps a higher touch, higher required compensation type relationship versus someone that tends to follow your advice. You do maybe quarterly reviews, semi-annual reviews, and they're somewhat set in their financial plan, retirement plan. So I think what's happened is the advisor definitely saying, you know, this client's paying me $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 a year. Are they getting the value? And I think what the CSA is missing is a lot of us will bring in accountants and legal professional help to look at, you know, wills, estate planning issues. I personally had a situation where a major Canadian accounting firm messed up on a terminal tax return, and they ran this as passive assets instead of active. It was a real estate developer who passed away. So we had them refile, and they got a $100,000 income tax refund. So the trailer amount, the MER, never really entered into that conversation with that client. That was a $100,000 check from CRA. I think too much of the conversation here is revolving around cost. I think the advice, you know, we just can't talk enough about the importance of advice. Jumping to point four, I'm reading this a little differently, enhanced disclosure of the MER. A lot of commenters have stated that we're not telling clients what the fund manufacturer is getting paid. So if the spirit of the guidance was tell clients what they're paying for their investment accounts and the services, we're not actually telling them that 1% is going to the manufacturer, and then 1% perhaps is going into trailing commissions, subsidizing DSC, and that type of thing. So I know in the insurance industry, they said a couple of years ago, why are we not disclosing the 2% plus the ER? Why are we only disclosing the 1%? So it's almost just only gone part way to tell clients as to what they're actually paying for the services.
Pete Cote, point number one, I think I'm the most fortunate advisor in the history of the industry because I have not had one single comment regarding disclosure. Not one. Not too high, not too low, not anything, not like nothing. And I spent...
Sorry, from investors or...
From investors.
Okay.
And I spent a lot of time leading up to CRM2 and everything saying, hey, this disclosure is coming and everything, but I don't think I was telling them anything new because I've always disclosed what my commission has been and I've always disclosed what the fees have been. And for those advisors who didn't do that, well, they were the ones who were probably most adversely affected by CRM2. But I think we're all dancing around the same issue. It comes back to a value proposition. If we're giving our clients value, regardless of what kind of advice we're giving them, they don't care about any of this stuff. They don't care what the MER is. They don't care about DSC. They don't care about whether I'm fee for service or commission paid or anything like that. Am I giving them what they need? Am I able to give them what they need, or am I at least smart enough to say, hey, I can't do that for you, but maybe Robert can, so I shuffle them across the street? And I think we're all dancing around how great this stuff is or how it had no effect or a large effect. It's about a value proposition. It's about giving clients what they need in order to properly plan, period.
Hi, my name is Wade Baldwin. I'm here as an independent financial advisor, but I'm also, like Robert, involved as a volunteer. I sit as the current past chair of Advocus nationally. But these comments really are more from my practice, my personal experience with disclosure. Finding that, again, very overwhelmed, the clients are overwhelmed with the amount of disclosure to the point where they're not reading it anymore. There's so much information that they are getting that they say, do I have to read this? And they don't read it. So perhaps an enhancement would be to simplify the process rather than to make it more onerous. We see the success of how FundFacts has replaced a simplified prospectus. Clients will actually read a FundFacts where they never would have read the simplified prospectus. Here, I think we can do it the same on disclosure by simplifying it with just, here's the points, not a three-page small font handout that you give to a client at account opening, along with the discussion that goes over top of it, because they get so many pieces of paper, they end up leaving it on my desk when they leave and say, can you shred it for me, because I really don't have time to read it all. So certainly that would be a comment. And then for number four, I just wanted to add to Mark as well. I agree with you, Mark. We really, if you were going to enhance, talk about the 2%, not just the 1%, the dealer and advisor compensation. If there was going to be some enhanced disclosure, explain to the client in there that it is going to the fund manufacturers for the ongoing research and management of those funds. Thanks.
And I think that, yeah. We do have that point for sure.
A couple of comments in regards to the enhanced disclosure. David Clark, BMO Global Asset Management. To the final point, would you support enhanced disclosure of the MER? I think it would also be important to itemize what is being provided at the manufacturer level in terms of legals, audits, custodial costs. You know, this is not all going to the bottom line of the manufacturer. There are operational costs. Couple of other sort of points here. Certainly the issue of disclosure fatigue has been brought up numerous times, so I would sort of reinforce that. My family just moved our investment portfolio from one provider to another, and we were provided with 86 pages of paperwork. The last comment that I will make is we're starting to see, with the regards to fund facts, we're starting to see the issue of regulatory arbitrage come back again, where the playing field is not level across mutual funds, exchange-traded funds, segregated funds. So we are certainly seeing among the advisor community sort of regulatory arbitrage shopping of, I'd prefer use a product that has less regulatory disclosure associated with it, even if that product is not as beneficial for the client situation, simply because it requires less time and effort and conversation by the advisor to educate the client.
I just want to do a quick check here. Have we got to most of the questions so far officially? Okay. All right, so a couple more hands, and then we'll move to the more general commentary to the extent it hasn't been caught. Sorry, Rob.
Thanks, Robert McCullough. The one thing that seems interesting here is we're only talking about the stream of information that the advisor presents at the opening of an account. It would be an interesting dialogue for us to talk about our competition with places in the fintech market, like Wealthsimple. We have a colleague who opened a Wealthsimple account. It took him 15 minutes to open his Wealthsimple account and move assets over. I know as an advisor I can't do that in less than an hour and a half. So how is it I need 90 minutes and all the disclosure and all of the things that are required, and yet the securities marketplace regulators have allowed fintech to move with such great speed and very little advice? So we should take some time and think about the arbitrage that has just been mentioned, but against fintech.
Regarding point one, my name is Jim Dernan. I'm a financial advisor. Definitely we're having more discussions about investor cost since the fun facts documents came out and investor cost disclosure requirements came out. Is it having a positive effect? Certainly in regards to clients fully understanding from a percentage basis and a dollar perspective what they are paying for their accounts being managed. Is absolutely true. I think the comment that you have and the question about it being a recent initiative, it is extremely recent. And as I mentioned earlier, I think this needs time to play out in regards to whether investors fully understand their cost of investing. For an account opening agreement, certainly it has to be a level playing field. The requirements for embedded compensation versus a fee-based account versus a robo-advisor, they should all be the same. We're dealing with the same individuals, and therefore the requirements should be the same. There should be no exemptions, no fast or shortcuts. In regards to Mr. Clark's comments on exchange-traded funds, it's certainly blossomed, I guess, from an exchange-traded fund industry perspective in the last 5 to 7 years, although they've been around a long time. And their requirements for disclosure just are not even close to what we have. And, in fact, the Know Your Product requirements probably are not even close to being there either, because there's a proliferation of these products and people don't understand the liquidity requirements or liquidity capability under adverse market conditions and what would be the eventual outcome to the investor. So proper disclosure, the same type of disclosure, should be absolutely necessary. You know, the MER from a total cost perspective is disclosed. You know, breaking it apart, how much GST and in some provinces HST clients are paying. I'm sure Albertans would be interested in regards to how much HST they're paying in a no HST province. You know, so I think that would be important disclosure as well, too, because they're paying a whole bunch of tax on their investments that they're not really aware of. And, you know, even to the credit of the fun facts, they even disclose the tertiary expense ratio, which only kind of geek advisors really understand what that was historically. So there's just a tremendous amount of disclosure in those documents. They're great, but I would say this, that they come at a cost to the investor. Like in my case, I've had to add a half a staff person to my team in order to deal with all the regulatory disclosures to my clients, regardless of whether they're reading them or not. And, in fact, I guess for the most part, we do get confirmation that they are read prior to doing the trade, but that's just them saying, yeah, I've read them. Whether they have or not is another question. So I think that's important. In regards to, no one commented on point three, you know, a list of services, you know, basically in my practice, it's kind of cradle to grave. And so, you know, it starts with budgeting and cash flow management, and then if they have children, to registered education savings plans, to, you know, financial independence, hopefully, then to estate planning. And it's truly cradle-to-grave advice. The only way that we're compensated, really, even though we cover all of those issues, is through either embedded trailers for perhaps very large accounts or deferred service charge or low load, because we don't generally charge for those advice. Estate planning, yes, if we write a life insurance policy, perhaps we would get compensated, but we don't always do that. In fact, we rarely do that in my practice. So, yeah, please consider those points.
All right.
Did you have one more?
Yeah.
Do that one, and then we'll... Oh, and one more over there. Yeah, sorry.
Hi, it's Rob Sklar. I can spend all day talking about regulatory arbitrage issues. You know, the one thing I'm concerned about in a fee-based world is that it isn't conflict-free. We've seen in the regulatory compliance reviews as well as the SRO reports that there are numerous conflicts that exist in a fee-based world. They're less regulated than mutual funds. They don't get as much information as people who invest in mutual funds. I mean, I can spend all day. There are tools that the regulators have at their disposal that they can use to protect investors against some of these conflicts. It's just, you know, unfortunate that it applies to mutual funds. It should be extended to apply to other types of investments like segregated funds and other types of investment products. The one thing, because we're on the topic of disclosure, that I wanted to note is that, you know, even as early as this morning, I saw, you know, another news report, another headline about hidden fees. The one thing that I take issue with here is that the embedded fee is not a hidden fee. I think it would be hard for us to sit here and say that, you know, the disclosure in the fund facts, the disclosure in the CRM2 reports, the disclosure in the prospectus, there is so much available that make this fee transparent. I have no issue. I think investor education disclosure is such an important tool. But you know, I can't sit here and say that these are hidden fees when they're not. I think investors, average investors, see these headlines, see the word hidden, and they think they're egregious, that they're bad. These are not bad. They're not egregious. And I think at the end of the day, the advice gap that we're most concerned with, if a ban proceeds, that you know, showing these investors a bill that they'll have to pay directly for their investment accounts that they, you know, not otherwise would have had a ban not proceeded, would quickly show them that you know, there's a big difference between a lack of understanding and you know, absolute, you know, oblivion, that they have no idea and they think these are free. I can tell you, as an average investor myself, I don't think they're hidden, and I don't think the cost of investment advice is free. So, you know, I find that there is a distinction to be made, but, you know, I think they're being led to believe that the embedded fee is hidden when it's absolutely not. Thank you.
Do you have one more? Okay.
You good? Okay.
Okay.
All right. So, we'll move away from the general or the specific questions, and I think probably with a view to time, we're going to wrap up here soon, but are there general comments, and I think we've also got general comments to this process, not presupposing there's none left, but so those have been valuable, and I haven't been writing, but we're going to have a record of everything, so I've been trying to take it in all in verbally, so but we do have a written record. Sorry, go ahead.
Mark Kent, Portfolio Strategies. I just want to come back to, you know, where the rubber meets the road, if I can use that term, with the end investor. I mean, I've been in the business 30 years, almost to the day, and I remember when we did a lot of planning work to land a client, and we'd say, well, this is how I can get paid. Deferred sales charge, 5% up front, goes to the dealer, it's financed, the MER over a series of years, you don't pay anything up front. Low load, 2%, shorter DSC schedule, or there's a front-end load or front-end zero. Now, this is back in the day when the Templeton Growth Fund paid 8.5%, and it was a non-negotiable upfront commission. So fast forward to today, I've got business owner clients that are wondering what Morneau's tax proposals are going to do to their tax planning with their family or family trusts. You have markets that are in turmoil in the global financial crisis, wondering, should I stay in equity? Should I be shifting? What should I be doing? So I could turn to that same client and say, okay, there's deferred sales charge clients, assuming I did that planning work up front. There's low load clients, and there's the front end zero clients. Mr. Investor, who do you want to be? Why don't we allow that client to say, I'm fine with the DSC. I want to get that call. If there's a pending tax change for December 31st and it's end of November, I want to be at the top of your list. And I think that's what industry is saying, that we need to offer choice to these clients. And I think the DSC, low load, front end zero, you put it that simply to a prospect and they say, I get it. Some may say, you know what, I get all my advice from my brother-in-law. He's a front-end zero client. I'm an order taker. I can choose to take on that client or not. But there's others that do need a significant level of advice, and a lot of them realize they're not going to get anything for free. And if it's a $20,000 investment and the only way I can get paid for my time is to do it on a deferred sales charge basis, then so be it. Let the clients decide. Many years ago, I had a client that came to me on a referral from the Royal Bank. She had all of her money in GICs, and she said, well, I was talking to my sister. She said I should start working with a planner. Well, she told me up front she had no intention of moving any of her money to me away from the Royal Bank. And I said, well, I'd rather stay home on a Saturday morning and watch cartoons with my kids than work on a retirement plan or a financial plan for someone who has no intention of ever giving me any assets. So years later, this client came back, and it started with $10,000, then $20,000, then it got up to $100,000. And then she said, can I get that financial plan now? Because she acknowledged that the planning that she got from the bank was just not up to her expectations. So again, you know, we go back to offering the consumer choice. The way I've laid it out, DSC, Lola, or front end, you can put that very simply in front of the average client, and they get it.
Hi, Wade Baldwin again. Recent Serrano studies show that with working with a financial advisor for a period of 15 years or longer, that we have about four times the investable assets than one that wasn't working with a financial advisor. So the system has worked the way it's worked, and it's worked well. And my comments would be, if it ain't broke, why are we trying to fix it? If the potential clients out there are having a problem with an embedded fee model, then currently they have the choice to move out of that model. They can move to a fee-for-service type of account. If we mandate that the only way we can compensate our financial advisor is by fee, then we're alienating all those other people that would choose the embedded commission model. So if it's not broke, why are we trying to fix it here? That's my comments.
Pete Cote, you started off today's session by saying you had 808 respondents to a survey, only of which 64% were investors or likely investors. And I think you've heard from a bunch of people today who have met with hundreds, if not thousands, of their own clients who seem to have an opinion that flies in the face of what you got. And I just wanted to make the comment that normally people respond to surveys, you know, this type of survey because the markets are down or the government's being annoying or they're not happy with their spouse or something like that. I would hate to have a decision made regarding the future of the industry and of our clients based on a survey result of 808 people in a province of 4 million. It doesn't seem to add up. So my comment is, you know, I agree with Wade wholeheartedly. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, and I don't think it's broke.
Hi, it's Rob Sklar. You know, one thing that I'd like to mention is, you know, we've seen in recent news articles over the past, you know, year or two that there's this trend, this global trend that's shifting towards limiting choice and limiting access to advice. Based on our own research internally and from speaking with the regulators around the world, you know, we see that the global trend is actually shifting away from that and is shifting more towards protecting choice and protecting access to advice. I absolutely think that if the regulators do proceed with a ban on the embedded fee model, that there will be an advice gap in Canada. We saw that happen in the UK, and we're going to see that happen here. it's really important that, we put forth in our comment letter, I think it was reminiscent seeing it in your deck, but, you know, about 11 different options that the regulators could consider as an alternative to a ban. I think there's lots of tools that you have at your fingertips that you can use to mitigate these conflicts while at the same time preserving choice for investors. Investors, Canadians deserve to have the right to choose how they wish to pay for financial advice. It's just, it seems absurd to think otherwise.
So, you know, I wanted to just conclude by saying that it's very important that we keep choice available. Thank you.
One, two, and then three at the back.
Ken Parker, Belay Wealth. For a long time, going back to when I was sitting on your side of the table, I've been fond of saying that too much disclosure is the same as no disclosure. And in recent years, the CSA has gotten a lot better with thinning down some of those requirements, like the fund facts. The fund facts is a very useful document with clients. A simplified prospectus tells them a lot more. And if you're lucky, it goes into a shredder to be recycled rather than into the landfill. So I would encourage the CSA to continue being very judicious in terms of imposing new disclosure requirements, because unless your client base is engineers and accountants and actuaries, far too often it's clear that that isn't read. And if it were read, your survey results would be different. Now, the second point is I would like to echo the comments about regulatory arbitrage and note that in the ASC's response in 2005 to the OSC's fair dealing model, that there was a comment in that response about too many so-called enhancements on the securities side favoring segregated funds, and I think that's still true. And I think one of these days that's something that the securities and insurance regulators should try to cooperate on, because in my experience there's still no meaningful regulation of segregated fund distribution. There's no meaningful retail regulation on the insurance industry.
Hi, it's Jim Dernan. I read a number of the papers. I didn't write one for 81408. I wrote one for 81407. This is kind of an offshoot from that in my mind. Fidelity's response on pages 12 to 23 should certainly be referenced. What the media certainly says is that jurisdictions are moving away from embedded compensation or deferred service charges, where the data that has been provided on those pages certainly supports to the contrary that information, in that 17 countries out of 21 surveyed have not discontinued embedded compensation. And it's really only two that we hear about, and that's Australia and the UK, that did discontinue deferred sales charges and embedded compensation. And then after RDR, they've done surveys, and there's a huge advice gap in particularly the UK that is written about. So, you know, please consider that as you move forward. I spoke today a couple of times about investor behavior. That for me is probably one of the biggest tickets in regards to what an advisor can do for their clients. And, you know, Dalbar does put out this information. It's publicly available. You don't even have to pay for it. You just have to Google it. And it's well worth the read, because it's 4% to 7% per year for long-term investors and how they mess themselves up. And I contend it's the independent advisor that does the best job, has the most vested interest in preserving their clients' investor behavior during times of challenges, which we have not seen, you know, since late 2008, 2009, of any particular seriousness. And then lastly, I'd like to make sure that clients, potential clients, have a choice in regards to how they pay the advisor. And, you know, you can think about perhaps, you know, do I hire a lawyer? And many people will not go and seek out a lawyer's advice because they know it's, geez, in today's world, $300 to $1,000 per hour after the first 30 minutes. So they just let things slide and don't seek advice when perhaps they need it. And that's certainly not the world that we want the average Canadian to be in. And it would be the world that they would be in, and then you'd have a large advice gap like in the UK. So thank you.
Okay. One more at the back, and then we'll have to call it.
David Clark, BMO Global Asset Management. I think a couple of things that come to mind here. So I think you get a sense from the field here that the folks who have attended here represent what I think is, you know, the pinnacle of integrity of this industry. And my question to you would be, what are we attempting to achieve through these regulations? And I think that perhaps the real outcome that we were attempting to achieve has been perhaps forgotten or hijacked or sidetracked. What we're attempting to achieve through these regulations, in my mind anyway, is to raise the bar on the integrity of the industry. You can't regulate integrity. Right now in Canada, there are zero mandatory qualifications to give advice to Canadians on matters of their financial affairs. Zero. No license required, no mandatory education. My 18-year-old nephew could hang a shingle right out of high school and call himself a financial advisor. The licensing requirements in this industry are atrociously low. A 90-day mail order course costs $300 to sell mutual funds in Canada. It's about the same to sell life insurance. 90 days, a few hundred dollars, write one exam, off you go. If you look at other professions in Canada, to make a pair of, you know, I look at the four of you up there, all four of you wear eyeglasses. To make you a pair of eyeglasses in Canada, it's a mandatory 2-year education process and provincial registration to make you a pair of eyeglasses. And yet, my 18-year-old cousin can finish high school, do zero education, and call himself a financial advisor. And so I think the real outcome that we're attempting to achieve here is, how do we raise the bar on the integrity of the industry? And I don't know. I don't think that this is the way to do it. I think that there are other avenues that we can look at to improve the overall integrity and ethics of this industry. And I think that this is perhaps a misguided attempt to regulate that level of education, ethics, and integrity that would improve the perception of the industry in everybody's mind.
Okay, I'm going to turn it back to Stan here.
Right. Just before we wind it up, were there any questions coming in via the webcast?
Yep.
Okay. Well, just to really wrap it up here, we'd like to thank you very much for having taken the time to provide us with your perspectives on this matter. You know, we will be considering what we heard in this town hall as we advance. So, again, we appreciate it. We've seen some familiar faces in the audience and some new faces, and we're pleased to have received your input. So thank you.